I want to pick up again now in volume 6 and begin at July the 27th, 1904. I have a VIP on this message as well. For one who truly loves God, all things are divine will. There's a huge statement. Everything must be sealed by love. So Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus came out from within my interior and holding my head up, for I was very tired because of the long waiting for him, he told me, my daughter, one who truly loves me in anything that happens to her, internal and external, devours everything as one single thing, which is the divine will. So that for someone who truly loves him, everything is taken up into divine will. Of all things, none seems strange to her, as she looks at it as a product of the divine will. Therefore, she consumes everything in the divine will. So her center, her aim, is only and solely the will of God. She always goes around within the divine will as though inside a ring, without ever finding the way out, and making of the divine will her continuous food. So the divine will is here pictured as a ring, and you're inside of this space and you cannot get out of it because it's eternal and it's infinite. So to be in there is already to experience paradise on earth. Later, Jesus came back and told Louisa, daughter, let everything in you be sealed by love. To put it very simply, everything is about love. Everything is about love. God is love. 1 John 4:7. The description of love is given in 1 Corinthians 13:1-13. And then 1 Corinthians 14:1 says you must want love more than anything else. You also have Matthew 22:37-40, where Jesus says that the two great laws that summarize the entire scriptures is love. Then we have Ephesians 3:16-21, that we must be founded on love, grow in love, be built on love, and reach the fullness of love. And you also have John 13:34-35, and that is that you must love one another in the same way as I loved you. That is divinely as well as humanly. Okay. And you have John 15:9. That is, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. And in the same way, you are to love one another. So it's all about love. The only baggage we're allowed when we leave this earth and take our flight to heaven, the only baggage permitted if you're going to heaven is love. Everything else is not needed. You have to leave it behind. Okay. So later Jesus came back and he told me, daughter, let everything in you be sealed by love. That is all your thoughts, all your words, all your motivations, all your actions, everything. If you think, you must only think of love. If you speak, if you work, if you palpitate, if you desire, if even just one desire is not love coming out of you, restricted within yourself, convert everything into love. In other words, if something inside of you doesn't want to be love, you've got to deal with it inside, and what comes out of you is love because the decision is to love. And so we have to battle with any contrary idea that comes to us, because the only thing that we're allowed to think, say or do is love if we want this great gift of living in the divine will. So if something that inside of you is not love, you must restrict it and you must convert it into love and then give it the freedom to go out, only then. And while saying this, he seemed to be touching my whole person with his hand, placing many seals of love. Now, to convert everything into love means that we reign in life with Christ. And that's Romans 5:17. Okay. And this whole thing of transforming everything into love simplifies life hugely. You accept things as expressing God's will or God's expressed will or God's permissive will, but for your good. And so you stop having the problems that other people have when they are living and thinking in a worldly way. So that message requires a good lot of thinking. July the 28th, 1904. The soul who is detached from everything finds God in all things. Now, notice the connection. If we are detached from the earth and detached from ourselves and from everything else, we will find God. If we are not detached, we won't find him because there's stuff blocking it. This morning, as I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Blessed Jesus came for just a little. And he told me, my daughter, when the soul is detached from everything, that is free, that you're not bound, you're not enslaved by anything. When the soul is detached and free from everything, in all things, then she finds God. There's nothing blocking the way. She finds him within herself. She finds him outside of herself. And she finds him in others, in other people. So it can be said that the soul who is completely detached, for a soul that is completely detached, all things convert or change into God. That's the most amazing reality. And it's what we are asked to move towards. Even more, she not only finds God, but contemplates him, feels him, embraces him. And since she finds him in everything, all things administer to her an occasion to adore him, to pray to him, to thank him, to draw close to him more intimately. And therefore, she is growing constantly, momentarily, every hour in holiness. And besides, your laments about my privation, the Lord said, are not completely reasonable, because he's explained to her over and over that the privations are because he needs to chastise and he needs to deal with the problems that are upon the earth. Because after all, he is King and Lord. He must deal with everything. If you feel me in your interior, he said, it's a sign that I'm not only outside of you, but also inside, as though in my own centre. Now, Louisa continuously acknowledges that he comes out from her centre. But that's not what she's looking for. She has been spoiled and she has seen him in the flesh so often that unless she sees him that way, she absolutely grieves. So look what he said. If you feel me in your interior, it is a sign that I'm not only outside of you, but also inside, as though in my own center. That means in my own tabernacle. I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3:16 there. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and God dwells in you? Then she said, I forgot to say at the beginning that the Queen Mother brought Jesus to me. And since I was praying him to content me and not to leave me without himself, blessed Jesus answered in the way that's given above. So we have another VIP message now on July the 29th, 1904, in which the Lord tells us that trust is absolutely vital in our relationship with God. You know that trust is basic to every real relationship, and it's basic to our relationship with God as well. The more we trust him, the more the relationship is on a solid footing. St. Therese of Lisieux was very strong about this, and she says that we will get from God only what we have confidence to receive. That confidence is that childlike trust in him. So faith, the heading here is faith makes one know God, but trust makes one find him. So it's the difference between simply just knowledge in your head and the reality of actually finding him. So continue in my usual state, Louisa said. As soon as I saw my adorable Jesus, I said to him, my Lord and my God. And he continued, God, God, God alone. Daughter, faith makes one know God, but trust makes one find him. So without trust, faith is sterile. You might end up just with doctrines, but never knowing him personally. Faith is sterile. And even though faith possesses immense riches with which the soul can enrich herself, if there's no trust, she remains always poor and lacking in everything. While he was saying this, I felt myself being drawn into God, and I remained absorbed in him like a little drop of water in the immense sea. Now, here's a little bit of what is essential in these writings, and that is my nothingness thrown into his allness. And my nothingness in the immense sea of his love is the reality that we're supposed to be living. As I looked, she said, I could find no boundaries, either of height or of depth. Heaven and earth, blessed and pilgrim souls, they were all immersed in this sea that we're calling God. I could also see wars, she said, like that between Russia and Japan, and thousands of soldiers who are dying and will die, and that by justice, also natural justice, the victory should be with Japan. And I saw that other European nations are plotting machinations of war even against nations of Europe. This is 1904, and this is the plans for World War I. But who can say all that I could see of God and in God? Now, notice that looking at God, you see all reality. This is where the prophets and the saints were able to tell us things about the future, because once they could really see God, they could see the reality that was going on the earth as well. So I want to give you Amos 3:7, that God never does anything without telling the prophets first. But it's important for us to recognize that when we truly contemplate God, we see reality as it really is, both in heaven and on earth. So July the 30th, 1904, is speaking about the detachment that priests ought to have. So this morning, Blessed Jesus was not coming, and Louisa said, and I, finding myself outside of myself, went round and round in search of my highest good. Now, that's the bride looking for the bridegroom in Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 2. And not finding him, my soul felt dying at each instant. But what increased my torment was that while I felt I was dying, I would not die. For if I could die, I would reach my intent to be forever with my centre, which is God. Put beside that 2 Corinthians 5:1 to 10. You may desire to be with God, but you need to choose to remain on the earth for as long as God wants. Oh, separation, how bitter and painful you are, she said. There's no pain that can be compared to you. Oh, divine privation, you consume, you pierce. You are a two-edged sword that cuts on one side and burns on the other. The pain you give is immense as is God himself, which means infinite. Now, while wandering around, I found myself in purgatory, Louisa said, and my sorrow and my crying seemed to increase the sorrow of those poor souls deprived of their life, which is God. The main agony of purgatory, of course, is that they have seen God and they desperately need him, just as Louisa has seen him and desperately needs him. So the pain she experiences is what we call purgatory. Among the souls in purgatory, there seem to be quite a few priests. one of whom seemed to be suffering more than the others, and he said to me, "My grave sufferings come from the fact that in life I was very attached to family interests and to earthly things, and I had a little attachment to some people." Now, what this soul is talking about is that one of the problems in the church in Italy at this time, 1904, was that families used to give their business to their sons who were priests, because everybody would trust the priest as being someone who was trustworthy, whereas they wouldn't trust one another in economy and in business. And so it actually drew the priest away from the holiness of his office and got him involved in business matters that he shouldn't be involved in. And so that's what this soul is talking about. "I got very attached to family interests and earthly things, and I had a little attachment to some people. This produces so much evil for the priest as to form an iron shell covered with mud that enwraps him like a garment, and only the fire of purgatory and the fire of the privation of God," this is what Louisa needs to learn, "which is such that compared to it, the first fire disappears, can destroy this shell." Now, the Lord is allowing Louisa to hear this from this priest so that she can hear that the pain of her privation is the most precious of her pains that she can offer to the Lord to release souls from purgatory and to save souls as well. The priest said, "Oh, how much I suffer. My pains are unutterable. Pray, pray for me." I felt even more tormented, and I found myself inside of myself," Louisa said. In other words, he spoke to her about the pain of privation. "Later, I saw just the shadow of Blessed Jesus, and he told me, 'My daughter, what were you searching for? For you, there are no other reliefs and helps but me alone.'" Because she's a victim soul, she has this absolutely privileged, special relationship with God, and there is nobody else that she can turn to. Nobody can relieve her. "He disappeared like a flash, and I was left saying, 'Ah, he himself tells me this, that he alone is everything for me. And yet he has the courage to leave me without deprived of him.'" So the pain of the privation is so great that she keeps forgetting that if she offers it, it will be an incredible leverage in her intercession. We now come to July the 31st, 1904. And this is a very important message about the problems of the human will. I've been saying to you that if we do not put the human will aside, the divine will cannot take over. It's as simple as that. So the heading is that the human will falsifies and profanes even the holiest works. You have to put a VIP on this and multiply it by about 10. "Continuing in my poor state," Louisa says, "it seemed that he came more than once, and I seemed to see him as a child, as though surrounded by a shadow. He said to me, 'My daughter, don't you feel the freshness of my shadow? Rest in it, for you will find refreshment.' And it seemed that we rested together in his shadow, and I felt all reinvigorated being close to him." Okay, so I want to give you a few references for the shadow of his wings. That is Psalm 17, verse 8, Psalm 36, verse 7, Psalm 57, verse 1, Psalm 63, verse 7, etc., etc. Okay. The shadow of his wings is one of the great images of the Bible. His shadow and I, when we rested together in his shadow, I felt reinvigorated being close to him. Then he continued, "My beloved, if you love me, I do not want you to look either inside or outside of yourself at whether you are warm or cold, whether you do much or you do little, or whether you suffer or you enjoy. all this must be destroyed in you. In other words, don't look at yourself at all. Let God take care of you, and you surrender completely, moment by moment, to the will of God as revealed to you. The other ways, that is the other ways of living a spiritual life, as high and sublime and industrious as they may be, that's 2 Corinthians 4, 16 to 18. 2 Corinthians 4, 16 to 18. So the other ways, as high and sublime and industrious as they may, cannot please me, and they cannot content my love. Oh, how many souls falsify true devotion and profane the holiest works with their own will, always seeking themselves. Now, this is something that is so vital, I have to illustrate it for you. I've given retreats for about 45 years in different countries. And the people who come on the retreats are people who are really seeking God. They're the holy ones. They're the daily mass goers. They're the ones who are doing the adoration. They're the ones who want to grow in holiness. But the strange thing is, when they come to the retreat house, they want the best rooms. They want all the luxury they can get. They want the best food. They want the best seats in the synagogue. They want all kinds of luxuries. And they will complain if the food isn't fantastic. And they will complain if the room isn't first class. What are we seeking? Ourselves or God? I've always been scandalized by this. And also amazed as well. So another illustration would be that you find people who seem to be very fervent in their prayer. And they'll spend hours in prayer when prayer is easy for them. But when prayer becomes difficult, oh, they won't be around because they're only finding their own satisfaction in the prayer. Now, as long as the human will is being satisfied, we're not surrendering at all to the divine will. And so this is the basic thing in our journey into the divine will, that if we do not put the human will aside, the divine will cannot take over. It's actually that simple. So Jesus continues, even in holy things, if one seeks her own way and her own taste and the satisfaction of herself, if she finds herself, she escapes from God and does not find him. Now, one of the things is very, very common in our churches is that people demand to sit in the same place all the time. And if you accidentally went into that place, you would find whether they were seeking God or not. I have been very strongly pushed out of particular places that I accidentally went into because it was my first time in the church. And you find that while this person appears to be coming to seek God, in actual fact, the human will is seeking all the satisfaction it can get. So I want to give you Matthew 10, 39 and Matthew 16, 25. Okay. So now we come to August the 4th, 1904. The state of the blessed in heaven will be according to the ways in which they comported themselves with God on earth. So you need to put a VIP on this. It's how we behave on earth that determines where we go in heaven and if we go to heaven. In other words, the ball is entirely in our court. So this morning when Blessed Jesus came, Louisa said, he transported me outside of myself, and taking me by the hand, he led me as far as underneath the vault of the heavens. Now, I've said before in these writings that Louisa is confined to a bed day in, day out, year in, year out. And the Lord balances that very confined experience by taking her soul in an out-of-the-body experience to let her experience the full expanse of the heavens. And he brings her around the earth. He takes her in all kinds of places so that she's not confined in the way that would look if you only look at her physically. So we went as far as the vault of the heavens, from where one could see the blessed and hear their chanting. Oh, how blessed, how the blessed were swimming in God. One could see their lives in God and the life of God in them. So you see that at this level, in this experience, that Louisa has spiritual vision, which is incredible. And so she can see things that on the earth are absolutely unavailable to us. One could see their lives in God and the life of God in them. This alone seems to me to be the whole essence of their happiness. So it's their union with God that creates their heaven. It also seems to me that each of the blessed is a new heaven in that blessed dwelling. Because you remember John 14 verses 1 to 2, in my Father's house there are many mansions and there's one for you. So each one of them has what we would call a mansion, she says, a new heaven in that blessed dwelling. But they're all distinct among themselves. There's no one similar to anybody else. Now look at this very carefully, because it means that each one of us is expected to bring back to heaven some unique testimony about God. And we get this unique testimony by our own personal experience of God. And nobody else ever will have that total experience but you. And so if we don't take that testimony back, heaven is lacking that particular stroke of the brush. There's no one similar to anybody else. And this happens according to the ways in which they comported themselves with God on the earth. One tried to love him more, and he will love him more in heaven. And will receive from God ever new and increasing love in such a way that this heaven will have a divine shade and feature which is all special to that love. Another tried to glorify him more, and blessed God will give him an ever increasing glory in such a way that this new heaven will be more glorious and glorified by the very divine glory. And so on with all the other distinct ways in which the saints actually wanted to serve him. And so it can be said, she said, that what we do for God on earth, we will continue in heaven. That's very, very interesting. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3, verses 11 to 15. What we do for God on earth, we shall continue in heaven, but with greater perfection. Therefore, the good we do is not temporary, but will last for eternity and will shine before God and around us continuously. 2 Corinthians 3, verses 1 to 3. Louisa continues, oh, how happy we will be in seeing that all our good and the glory we give to God, as well as our own, comes from that little bit of good that we started imperfectly in heaven. Now, in Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 8, he says that the little bit of suffering we get in this earth cannot be compared to the glory that God gives to us in heaven, which is out of all proportion to what we suffered for him on the earth. If all could see this, she said, oh, how they would hasten to love more, to praise, to thank and to do other things for the Lord so as to be able to do it with greater intensity in heaven. But who can say everything? Rather, it seems to me that I'm speaking a lot of nonsense about this blessed dwelling place. She uses that expression when she says, I'm not sure if I'm communicating. My mind has it in one way, but my mouth cannot find the words. That's 1 Corinthians 2:9. That the things that God has prepared for those who love him are beyond what the mind can cope with, what the eyes can see and the heart can understand. Then afterwards, the Lord transported me to earth, she says. Oh, how horrifying are the troubles on the earth in these sad times. Yet it seems that this is still nothing to compare to what is to come, both in the religious state, So much so that it seems that the church, this good and holy mother, will be torn to shreds by her very children. Here again, you need to put Amos 3:7. God is showing her something ahead of time. And the wreckage that we see in the church today is what she's looking at. It didn't begin today. We are experiencing the very bitter fruits of what was produced in the 20th century. She said, and yet it seems this is still nothing compared to what will come, both in the religious state, so much so that it seems that the church, this good and holy mother, will be torn to shreds by her very children. And also in the secular state, so in the political as well as religious spheres. Then after this, he took me back into myself and told me, tell me a little bit, my daughter, how am I for you? And Louisa said, you are everything for me. Nothing enters into me. Everything flows outside but you alone. And he said, and I am all for you. Now that's the marvellous exchange. O admirabile commercium is what the church used to say in Latin. What an incredible exchange that we give ourselves to God and God gives himself fully to us. So that's Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 10. So he said, and I am all for you. Nothing of you goes out of me. And I delight all of myself in you. So from the very way I am with you, you can see how you are with me. And he disappeared, leaving her to think about that. So August the 5th, 1904, Jesus is the ruler of kings and the Lord of lords. Okay. He is Adon Adonim, that is Lord of lords, and Melech Melechim, King of kings. I've given you the Hebrew words. So I want to give you Revelation 17:4, where that is declared that he's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Continue in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little, in the act of ruling and dominating everything, and of reigning with the crown of a king on his head, and with the scepter of command in his hand. You remember John 19, when Pilate said, are you a king? And Jesus said, yes, I am. But I'm not a king of this world, which of course left Pilate completely not understanding. While I was seeing him in this position, he told me, though in Latin, but I will say it according to what I understand, she said, my daughter, I am the ruler of kings and the Lord of lords. So I want to give you 1 Timothy 6:15 and Revelation 19:16, where this is declared. To me alone is this right of justice due, which the soul owes me. And by not giving it to me, she denies me as creator and master of everything. You see, we're the only creatures in the universe who have free will. And therefore, we're the only ones who can actually deny something to God. And we have a much greater responsibility than all other creatures to actually give God what he's looking for. So if she denies me as creator and master of everything. While saying this, he seemed to take the world in his hand and to turn it upside down so that human creatures would submit to his regime and dominion. Now, turning it upside down, of course, is allowing incredible disasters to happen to try and shake us up. At the same time, I could see how the Lord ruled and dominated in my soul, Luke 17:21. With such mastery that I felt all submerged in him. From him came the rule of my mind, of my affections, of my desires. Many electric wires passed between me and him, through which he directed and dominated everything. In other words, in Louisa, he was, in fact, Lord. Many people sing, he is Lord, but they don't allow him to actually rule in them as Lord. So August the 6th, 1904. The privation is a pain of fire that ignites, consumes, annihilates, and its purpose is to destroy human life and constitute divine. So now we're going to be talking about this privation that is worrying Louisa very much. This morning I went through the most bitter time because of the privation of my highest and only good, Louisa says. The sorrow of the privation was such that as I found myself outside of myself, the pain of my soul was so great that the pain itself administered such strength to it that it wanted to destroy whatever it found as hindrance to finding its all, who is God. So here you have something that only the victim souls and people who have been really graced to suffer can actually testify to us. The rest of us have to take it as it is said to us. And that is that when a person suffers this deep, deep, deep pain in their innermost being, while it is awful suffering, at the same time, it gives immense strength or fortitude to the soul. So I want to give you Psalm 63 and Psalm 42 there. And then Louisa said, and not finding him, now she's in an out-of-the-body experience, the soul would shout and cry and run more than the wind. It wanted to upset everything, to turn everything upside down in order to find the life that it was lacking. Oh, privation, how intense is your bitterness, she says. Your sorrow is always new, and because it is new, the soul feels the bitterness of the pain as ever new. My soul feels as if one whole flesh would separate into many shreds, and all those shreds with justice ask for their life and will find it only when they find God. Now here you've got a pain that most of us have no comprehension of at all, but the souls in purgatory would understand, because it is pain like their pain. But who can say the state that I am in? Meanwhile, angels, saints and purging souls rushed up to me, placing themselves in a circle around me and preventing me from running, sympathizing with me and assisting me. But everything was useless for me, because in them I could not find the one who alone could soothe my pain and restore my life. And so I shouted more, crying out, tell me, where can I find him? That's the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. And Louisa is illustrating what St. Teresa of Avila told us, that God alone sufficeth. The only person who can actually bring us to a place of peace and calm and rest is God alone, nobody else and nothing else. And so Louisa said to them, if you want to have pity on me, do not delay showing him to me, for I can take no more. Then after this, he came out from within the depth of my soul. He's there all the time. But she has this desperate need to see him outside of herself and to see him full bodied, as we would say. And it seemed that he pretended to be sleeping, while being concerned about the hardness of my, without being concerned about the difficulty of my poor state. But even though he would not bother and was sleeping, at merely seeing him, I breathed my life as one breathes air. Ah, here he is with me. However, I was not freed of the pain in seeing that he would not even pay attention to me. So love demands a response of love from the beloved. Then after much suffering, as if he had awakened, he said, my daughter, all other tribulations can be penances, expiations, compensations, but only the privation of the Lord is a pain of fire that ignites, consumes, annihilates, and does not give up until the human life is destroyed. The human life means the human will. But while it consumes, it also vivifies and it constitutes divine life in it. So she's being consumed by divine love and she just needs to understand what's actually going on. That's Hebrews 12, 29. Matthew 3:11 also says that the Holy Spirit is fire and that we have to be baptized with this fire that will consume us and make us ready for the divine fire, which is heaven. August the 7th, 1904. The first to persecute the church will be religious, the religious ones. Okay. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself surrounded by angels and saints who said to me, it's necessary that you suffer more for the imminent things that are about to happen against the church. Now, at the time that this message is given, the communists have already begun infiltrating the church to do the most devastating damage to it that we're still suffering from today. And the communists will be followed by the Freemasons, who will make it even worse. Because Satan had asked for 100 years to destroy the church and he was given permission. Why would he be given permission? It's because that 100 years was a test and the church should have been able to respond and should have been able to pass the test and grow in holiness and glorify God. In actual fact, the church seems to be disintegrating. And I mean the church in all its denominations. So the angels and the saints said to Louisa, it's necessary that you suffer more for the imminent things that are about to happen against the church. For if they do not come about immediately, time will make them happen in a milder way and with less offence to God. So if Louisa suffers for them again, it won't be as terrible as it might have been. And Louisa said, is suffering perhaps in my power? If the Lord gives it to me, I will gladly suffer. Meanwhile, they took me and brought me before the throne of our Lord, and they prayed together that he would make me suffer. And blessed Jesus, coming towards us in the form of the crucified, shared his pains with me. Now notice it's the angels and the saints that are interceding, that the terrifying attack that was going to come to the church would be less, and that their interest and their intercession for us in heaven is something we need to take note of. So Jesus accepts the prayer and intercession of the saints in heaven for the pilgrim souls on earth. Afterwards, Jesus said to me, my daughter, sufferings divert my just indignation, and the light of grace is renewed in human minds. That's what is produced by this voluntary suffering of Louisa. And that is that grace is given to people and therefore an opportunity to change and to convert and come back to God and stop the disaster. Ah, daughter, Jesus said, do you think that it will be the lay people who will be the first to persecute the church? Now, they say secular. I'm saying lay. It's probably you mean the people who are outside the church, the political and social sphere that he's actually talking about. Do you think the world, we would say, will persecute the church? He said no. It will be the religious, the very leaders who, pretending to be sons and shepherds, while in reality they are poisonous snakes that poison themselves and others, will begin among themselves to lacerate this good mother. And then the laity or the people outside the society will follow. And this is happening as we're speaking. The disasters that is happening, the church, as a result of all this sexual deviation and all the crimes that have been committed. This will be followed by persecution as night follows day. And so the sexual side of it wasn't the beginning. The beginning was rationalism, humanism, modernism, secularism. Okay? And so Jesus says in Matthew 7:15 that some leaders are wolves in sheep's clothing. Unfortunately, we have some today. And then Louisa finishes this by saying, obedience called me and the Lord withdrew. Okay. So August the 8th, 1904. I have a VIP on this one as well. The soul must look for Jesus within herself, not outside. Now, poor Louisa has Jesus all the time inside and she's always looking outside. If you remember the Confessions of St. Augustine, he said, I looked for you outside and you were within. Okay. Jesus, of course, said in the gospel that the kingdom of God is within us, Luke 17:21. While I continued struggling, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came for just a little. But even though I felt him near me, I would try to grab him and he would escape, almost preventing me from going outside of myself to go in search of him. Then after I struggled very much, he made himself seen for just a little and told me, my daughter, do not look for me outside of yourself, but within yourself in the depth of your soul. Because that's where the kingdom of God is. Because if you go outside and do not find me, you will suffer very much and will not be able to endure. If you can find me more easily, why do you want to struggle more? And Louisa said, it's because I believe that not finding you immediately within myself, I can find you outside. It's love that pushes me to do this. And Jesus said, ah, it's love that pushes you to do this. Everything should be enclosed in one single word, love. 1 John 4:7, God is love. Ephesians 3:16-21, you must grow to full maturity in love. 1 Corinthians 14:1, you must want love more than anything else. And then Psalm 145:17, God only ever acts out of love. A summary of the 36 volumes of Louisa Picaretta is this: divine will and love. Why is that? Because God, who is the divine will, is love. The divine will is the operating part of the Blessed Trinity, but the reality of the nature of the Blessed Trinity is that it is love. So if we're not growing in love, we're not growing in divine will. If we are growing in love, we're growing in divine will. Ah, he said, everything should be enclosed in one single word, love. If the soul does not enclose everything in this, it can be said that she does not know a thing about loving me. And according to how much the soul loves me, do I expand the gift of suffering. Notice the gift of suffering. Most of us don't want to think of suffering as a gift. So Louisa, interrupting Jesus, all surprised and afflicted, said, my life and my whole good, she said, so since I suffer little or nothing, I love you little or not at all. What fright, the mere thought that I do not love you. My soul feels a sharp disappointment and I almost feel offended by you. And he added, I do not intend to disappoint you. Your disappointment would press on my heart more than your own. And besides, you must not look at the mere corporal sufferings, but also at the spiritual sufferings and at the true will you have to suffer. You see, many people don't have physical sufferings on the outside, but they can be suffering dreadfully, mentally and emotionally and spiritually, all three or even one of them. And sometimes in the spiritual life, you have spiritual suffering that has no name. And we just don't know why we're suffering so deeply inside. And it's because the Lord is actually purifying us. Besides, he said, do not look at the mere corporal sufferings, but also at the spiritual and at the true will you have to suffer. Because if the soul truly wants to suffer, for me, it is as if the soul has done it. That's a terribly important statement. If you truly want to love the Lord, then as far as he's concerned, you have loved him. If you do something and you want to do it for him, as far as he's concerned, it is done for him. Therefore, calm yourself and do not be troubled, and let me continue speaking. Now, notice that Jesus says here, and he has said it before, that the intention is accepted as the accomplished deed. This is very, very important. He said, haven't you ever seen two intimate friends? Oh, how they try to imitate each other and to reproduce the other within themselves. They imitate the voice, the manners, the steps, the works, the clothes, in such a way as the friend can say, the one who loves me is another me. And since he is me, I cannot help loving him. We see this very much with the youth culture imitating their football fans or their actors and actresses that they want to imitate. He said, that's what I do with the soul who encloses all of me within herself as though within a small circle of love. When he says that all of him can be reflected in us as within a small circle of love, think of a drop of water reflecting the whole sky. The whole sky can be reflected there, but the drop of water is infinitely smaller. And so in the same way, the Lord can reflect himself in us, even though we are infinitely small. I feel as though reproduced within her, he said, and finding myself, I love her with all my heart, and I cannot do without being with her, because if I leave her, I would leave myself. So what Jesus is talking about there is this oneness that you have in John 14, 20 to 21. I will dwell in you and you will dwell in me. Both of us will be completely one. And so this is the reality that is there for us in union with God. Notice you can't really have the divine will without union with God. So August the 9th, 1904, this is a very important message about obedience as essential in the divine will. It's not the works that constitute the merit of man, it's obedience alone. This is very important. So it's not the suffering that Louisa is doing, it's the fact that it's in obedience to the divine will, that whatever we do is in obedience to the divine will. After delaying, Jesus came for just a little like a bolt of light. 1 John 1:5, God is light. And I was left filled with this light inside and out. I am unable to say what my soul understood and experienced within this light. I will only say that afterwards, blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, it's not the works that constitute the merit of man, but it's the obedience to divine will alone that constitute all merits as a birth from the divine will. In other words, if it comes from the divine will, Jesus calls it a birth from the divine will. So much so that everything I did and suffered in the course of my life, everything was a birth from the will of God. Now, many times I have given you John's Gospel, John 5, 30, 7, 16, 8, 28, 29, 8, 55, 10, 29, 38, 12, 50, 14, 31. This is all a summary of John's Gospel. And it ends with this marvellous statement in John 14, 31. I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly as my Father tells me. Now, Jesus also said in the Gospel, if you love me, you will keep my word. And therefore, we have to show our love to Jesus by actually obeying his commandments. by actually fulfilling his word, by letting it become reality in us. Okay. So Jesus said, everything in my life was a birth from the will of the Father. This is why my merits are innumerable, because they are constituted by divine obedience and therefore they are infinite merits. Therefore, I do not look so much to the multiplicity and greatness of the works, but at the connection that they have, either directly with divine obedience or indirectly with obedience to one who represents me. So there's no way out of this for each one of us. No way at all. If that obedience isn't there, then we are not living divine will. It's that simple. So let's go on to August the 10th, 1904. God knows the number, the value, and the weight of all created things. Now, for that, I want to give you Psalm 139. You know my thoughts before I think them, my words before I say them. This is too wonderful for me. I want to give you Matthew 10:30 as well. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself wandering around churches. There she is sitting in her bed, apparently totally confined, but her soul is out of her body and she's wandering around the churches, making a pilgrimage to Jesus in the most holy Eucharist, together with my guardian angel. In one of the churches, I said, prisoner of love, you are here abandoned and alone, and I have come to keep you company. And while keeping you company, I intend, now notice the intention, the placing of the intention is extremely important. I intend to love you for those who offend you, praise you for those who despise you, thank you for those in whom you pour graces, but do not render you the tribute of thanksgiving. I want to console you for those who afflict you and repair for any offence against you. In a word, I intend to do for you all that others are obliged to do for you for having remained in the most holy sacrament. And I also intend to repeat this for as many drops of water, for as many fish and grains of sand in the seashore. So here she is multiplying the prayer. We can do this very simply by just simply saying, Lord, I multiply this to the infinite. While I was saying this, all the waters of the sea became present before my mind. And I said within myself, my sight cannot grasp the whole vastness of the sea, nor does it know the depth and weight of those immense waters. But the Lord knows. He knows their number, their weight, and their measure. And I stayed there quite marveling. At that moment, blessed Jesus told me, silly, silly that you are. Why do you marvel so much? What is difficult and impossible for the creature is easy and possible and also natural for the Creator. Now that's repeated quite a number of times in Scripture. I'm going to give you Luke 1:38. Nothing is impossible with God. Matthew 19:26. Again, nothing is impossible with God. All things are possible for him. It happens in this as to someone who, looking at millions and millions of coins in the twinkling of an eye, says they are innumerable, who can count them? But the one who put them in that place tells everything in one word. They are this many, they are worth this much, and they weigh that amount. My daughter, I know how many drops of water I myself put into the sea. And no one can disperse even a single one of them. I numbered everything. I weighed everything. I evaluated everything. And so with everything else. He's also told us that he has counted the hairs on our heads. So what is the marvel if I know everything? God is omniscient. And not only is he omniscient, he's omnipotent. He can do anything. On hearing this, every marvel ceased. Or rather, I marvelled at my silliness, she said. We need to realise that, you know, after all this length of history, we have discovered in the third millennium after Christ, that there's approximately 100 billion galaxies in the sky and growing. So we'll never know the number of things, and there's billions of stars in each one of these galaxies. So the number is known only to God. He needs to keep some things for himself, I think, don't you? Let's do one more. August the 12th, 1904. Man disperses the beauty with which God created him. As I continued struggling, all of a sudden I found all of myself inside the Lord. And from his head, a shining thread descended into mine, which bound me completely inside of Jesus. Oh, how happy I was to be inside of him. As much as I looked, I could see nothing but him alone. This is my highest happiness, only Jesus, him alone, and nothing else. Oh, how well one feels. Meanwhile, he told me, "Courage, my daughter. Don't you see how the thread of my will binds you completely inside of me? So if any other will wants to bind you, if it is not holy, it cannot. Because since you are inside of me, if it is not holy, it cannot enter into me." So I want to give you Leviticus 19:2. And Hebrews 12:14, and I'll give you a few more in a minute. And while saying this, he looked at me over and over again, and then he added, "I created the soul with a rare beauty. I endowed her with a light superior to any other created light, and yet man disperses this beauty inside of ugliness and this light inside of darkness." I want to give you 1 Peter 1:15-16. I want to give you Revelation 21:27 and 1 Corinthians 3:17, for the temple of God is holy. And we leave it there for now.